At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex.
It was a stunning case that ultimately revealed the secretly perverse lifestyle Wesson had forced his family to lead.
It was more like an organized crime family.
According to Yahweh's law, that was just the way it was supposed to be.
One verse that said if you don't like him, kill him. I really wish I could find it.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys for listening. I love you. And keep connecting with us on Instagram at Seven Deadly Sinners Podcast. And I'll be updating the Instagram with visuals from this episode. I hadn't for the first five parts of the Franklin scandal because it was so covered up there wasn't a ton of photos. And I didn't want to keep posting Larry King's bloated face over and over again or the very sad witness testimony videos. But this next bit has some more investigative details you'll want to follow along with. And you can also look up Seven Deadly Sinners on the Vodacast app, which is today's sponsor, and follow along with photos and videos there. I'll explain more on that in a bit. Okay, next season is fast approaching, and I wanted to do something special. I want to choose at least three of your cases for next season. And if I end up choosing more hell, we can just keep the seven deadly sins rolling and do a couple on greed or lust, etc., if need be. I'm the boss here. Let's just live. So if you want to get your case suggestion seen, the best thing to do is leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts with your suggestion in the comments, and then follow up with an email at sevendeadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. I always see the comments on Apple Podcasts, and then it just helps to move your case suggestions to the top of the list, and having it be seen by others gets people excited for next season and what's to come. It's a win-win. Now for the crime. And as always with this case, trigger warning. This episode will predominantly include the abduction of children, abuse of children, and sexual abuse of children. So please take care when listening. But we're finally here, finally past all the backstory of the Franklin scandal. And we are now connecting so many freaking leads that could help to solve other missing or murdered children's cases and show that this was essentially an epidemic in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Hell, it's worse today, probably. But today, these predators now can hide behind layers of security on the dark web. They don't necessarily need to form bonds with other predators to make the operation happen, which back in the day left clear breadcrumb trails leading back to the same criminal rings, heads of these rings, trusted organizations they infiltrated, and even organizations they created to facilitate their dirty deeds. You see, 30, 40 years ago, if you wanted to be a scumbag, your biggest means of acquiring your visual materials, i.e. child sexual abuse material, was through the mail. And as we've come to know, most sexual abuse cases toward children are from someone they know. But during this time, it seems that there was an undeniable rip in this logic. This was during the era of riding your bike well into the dark or taking on what could be considered adult chores alone, like walking a couple miles to a grocery store for an ingredient for the family dinner. But there was a sense of innocence that was soon lost around this time, as kids were being plucked off the street. And it took a few extreme cases to get that alarm bell ringing in parents' heads. Your child is not unquestionably safe at camp. Your child is not unquestionably safe at church. And your child is not unquestionably safe within blocks of your own home or in your quiet suburban neighborhood. And Johnny Gosch would unfortunately be the first kid to teach us this lesson. Are you like me, and when you get super into a podcast, you just have to know what the people looked like or what the crime scene looked like? Well, now you don't have to do the heavy lifting, because this cool new app called Vodacast has done the heavy lifting for you. Vodacast is an amazing new immersive podcast app that will allow you to experience this podcast and others in a way you haven't been able to until now. Vodacast will provide you a deeper version of the show and allow you to view photos of the people and places we're talking about in this episode. You'll also get links for articles about the case. When you experience a podcast on Vodacast, you not only will be listening to your favorite podcast, but you'll be digging into stories that will come alive with supplemental digital content that allows you to have everything being discussed in the episode at your fingertips. I mean, like I said, if you're like me, after you listen to a podcast, you search for more details, photos of the people, events discussed in the episode. With Vodacast, it's all right there for you. So try Vodacast out today. Click on the link in my show notes to learn more about Vodacast, or download the app today in the App Store and change the way you experience podcasts forever. That's Vodacast, V-O-D-A-C-A-S-T. And I'm not discounting that, yes, children did run away or were from broken homes or were kicked out of their home or were just completely neglected to such severe degrees that they had to perhaps become an adult before they were even 13 to maybe take care of a younger sibling or just to eat or sleep somewhere with shelter. So many children were often ignored in these situations, discarded as wayward runaways that deserved their fate. But the abused kids of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and again, likely today, aren't always from broken homes. And honestly, what the fuck does it matter anyway? The point is, it's our job to shelter and wrap security around the vulnerable. Not spend all our resources siding with the people abusing them to maintain, I don't know, what is it, social dignity, or to maintain an air of suburbanoid delusion. I think I made up that word. Just go with it, guys. I mean, just enough of a teeny bit of justice is all they'll give us. Just a little bit to satisfy our need for safety and security. So we can go to sleep at night and feel that we can stomach all of this. So they just arrest one person, but he just kind of goes to jail for, like, I don't know, 10 months or something, even though he did something horrible. But it makes us feel good because at least we can maintain a social relationship with high-level public servants or local congressmen, heads of your church, owners of your kids' summer camp. And I'm not saying we all do this. I'm thinking of the 80s. It just seemed like this was the case. The authorities just wanted to cover it up. And it's not these parents' fault. Child predators are good. They're really good. And I'm generalizing, but they're smart people. They can hold a conversation about anything. They seem into philanthropy. But most poignantly, they fly under the radar by being so obvious. Before we go into this montage of sorts I've created, that the clips are pulled from a 1981 documentary called Boys for Sale. That was, just like Conspiracy of Silence, pretty much pulled from air or only aired in certain districts, and that was a shock. But the clips that you're going to hear, many of them are from interviews later, like a panel discussion with Dr. Tom Philpott, who is the one that put the whole thing together. I think he seems quite lovely, and very well spoken, and even for decades ago, is pretty PC in the way he talks. I really appreciate it. Additionally, he, like other people that have tried to expose the corruption and the abuse of children in our country, was probably murdered. More on that in a bit. So here's some clips from Boys for Sale and a little bit from Johnny Gosch's story, just to set the tone.
The kind of individuals involved are down the line, almost in every instance in the cases I've investigated, men who are very powerful, usually very wealthy, and usually administrate control over a large number of people.
Wealthy Houstonians can and do obtain boys in a most discreet manner.
Tom, can you first give a case history? Just kind of a typical case history, and then we'll talk in greater detail about what happens.
All right, I can tell you the biography of a little kid from a hollow in West Virginia whose mom and dad went to Houston to find work. They thought that Houston was the capital of opportunity in America. The dad went out there to get a job, a low-level job with an oil company, brought the mother, then sent for little Jimmy and his little brother. Jimmy and his brother got to Houston on a Greyhound bus, and his dad and mom failed to pick him up.
How old were they?
Jimmy at that time was 12 and his little brother was 6. They spent the night in the terminal, Jimmy fending off the advances of a number of men. And then the dad came to pick him up the next morning. The parents had both gotten drunk and forgotten to pick up the kids. The boys went to live with their parents. The parents both had severe drinking problems. The dad lost his job. The mother got killed in a car wreck. The little boy was severely injured. Jimmy dropped out of school to try to hustle, was his word, money to help keep the family, what was left of it, together. The dad died choking in his own vomit after a drinking bout. And Jimmy was the sole support of himself and his little brother. The rent was coming round, and Jimmy had no money. And then a neighbor kid said to him, "You can get $10 just for watching me play with a man." Jimmy did it. Then the man offered Jimmy $25 to let the man play with Jimmy. And Jimmy took it, so he had $35. And then he got introduced into the routine. Jimmy was little, only 12, and he was small for his age. He survived in that capacity until he was 14. Jimmy disappeared. His body was later found mutilated.
How widespread is it?
If you get in a car and prowl the streets of the capitals of this practice, Houston, New Orleans, Atlanta, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles,
we were told by government agencies, well, you have to prove that child's in danger. To us, he's a runaway until you prove he's in danger. You can almost become catatonic. You can almost go into a state of mind where you don't want to talk to anybody ever again. Not trust anybody ever again. That's our boy's life.
Investigations in other cities have shown that boys 13, 14, even younger, are coerced into prostitution with threats of physical violence and are sometimes shipped across state lines, shipped to the older adult men who desire young boys for sexual acts. Occasionally, these boys' episodes with their older clients ends in physical violence. There are men who seek young boys to torture and sometimes to kill.
Silver and Black Ford Fairmont start up from the area where John Gosch was last seen and made a left turn after rolling through the stop sign without stopping.
And they just thought, like all cops do, it's a runaway. A kid ran away. Now, this kid didn't run away. Johnny was our paper boy. I knew him, knew his parents, been out to dinner with him. Johnny would not run away.
It's gotten a little more sophisticated now. It's gotten more it's gotten more expensive. Prices, higher prices are paid. And it's It's gotten a little more sophisticated in terms of, I think the types of people who are into it, types of adults who are into it, professional people.
The police had later found in his home a file, an index file, of anywhere from 200 to 500 names of young boys that had their names, phone numbers, parents' names, in many cases, sexual statistics on the personnel, height, age, weight, and in some cases, preferences. And that sounded like an astounding thing to us.
You don't want to stay alive?
I mean, I want to stay alive and all, but, you know, if I die, what the... I mean, it can't be much worse.
I know. I mean, is it that bad out there? Don't you look forward to the day when you get a good job?
Yeah, but that's all I can do is look forward, you know? Live each day as it comes.
It's pretty shocking. But before we get to Johnny's case, let's think back to all of the stories and evidence and testimony from child victims that overlap and corroborate with each other in the prior episodes. The same stories of influential people, interstate flights, and even the ones that involve such difficult to wrap your head around concepts as children being bought and sold, abused and discarded, threatened, and even murdered. Just remember those as we continue on, and especially right now. So, these organized pedophile rings would not only infiltrate, you know, boys' homes, Boy Scouts, whatever. They would create them to have their own breeding ground for their own gross... Ugh. So they would create their own charitable organizations, advertise as safe havens for kids, only for the kid to arrive at, say, for example, Boys Farm in Tennessee, which was run by a priest named Bud Vermeil, or a private island in Lake Michigan, where there was only one way in and one way out, by plane. This island was touted to children and their parents as Brother Paul's mission. They persuaded families to send their boys there with the promise of a beautiful summer, spent hiking and swimming and learning about nature with other kids. And, like, who wouldn't want that for their kid? But instead, it was an absolute nightmare. Brother Paul's mission was a cover-up for wealthy pedophile Francis Sheldon and his buddies to sexually abuse and film the little boy victims, and then distribute that child sexual abuse material all over the country to the assholes that couldn't attend the island. Sound familiar? I think Epstein got his idea from Francis Sheldon. And probably Larry King too, because it was always a private plane taking kids back and forth. And with that ring and the child sexual abuse material being produced there, they made loads of money. So much so that local gym teacher, amateur photographer, and magician Gerald Richards said in an interview from prison that the money was just too good to leave it behind. Jerry was also a child predator and monster himself. Though I will say, at least from prison, he claimed he did want to help, to give information to journalists and authorities so they could learn more of what was going on. It doesn't get him off for what he did. But also, Jerry Richards was the only man arrested in July of 1976, once North Fox Island, also known as Brother Paul's Mission, was busted after an 8-year-old boy had to be hospitalized for the damage done to him at the island's boys' camp. And when he told a shocking story. He told of CEOs in the Detroit area and around the country, politicians, extremely wealthy, prominent men from around the area and beyond who would come to the island and horrifically abuse these boys. You see, these men would donate to the charity that was a front for what the island was really used for. But their donations were like an in, like they bought them a ticket to the island and an opportunity or... I mean, their money basically just said to Francis Sheldon, I'm allowed to do whatever I want with these boys. It's truly disgusting. So, why was Jerry Richards the only man arrested for these crimes? Well, he was the only middle class, or maybe even lower middle class, perpetrator making an average wage, not from family money. You see, Francis Sheldon, the owner of the island and pilot of the plane that would bring the boys there, was loaded. He owned the island. He had political connections, the means, and the motivation to completely disappear, move to Europe, and never be caught up with again. You see, political connections, connections to local authorities, will go a long way when you're running a pedophile ring. You're one step ahead. You can buy people off. And when Jerry was arrested, someone in the precinct, when he was interviewed, tipped off Francis Sheldon. And he, before anyone could clap handcuffs on his dainty little pedophile wrists, he was gone. He'd cleared out his Ann Arbor, Michigan home, and he was on a private plane to Europe, never to be heard from again. And the other thing about Francis Sheldon, he was in-your-face bold. In an interview I heard on the brilliant podcast, The Clown and the Candyman, one child victim, now an adult, they caught up with, who is scarred to his core from the abuse he endured. He says that he was introduced into the ring and invited to the island by his neighbor and mentor in the field of learning magic, Gerald Richards. But the boldness of this ring doesn't stop there. No, no. Gerald eventually introduced the boy to Francis Sheldon, who had already begun abusing the boy and bringing him to the island. But he more than just introduced Francis Sheldon to the boy, he introduced him to the boy's parents. And the boy, who was too scared and traumatized and confused to tell his parents what was happening to him at the hands of his neighbor, at the hands of the boys' camp leader, that boy, Francis Sheldon, Gerald Richards, and the boy's parents sat down and broke bread together more than once. The boy's mother invited these creeps into her home, having no idea what evil she'd let through that door, and made them a home-cooked meal. It's disgusting. Now, there's also a lot of people that suspect that that ring was connected to the Oakland County child killings. And I may go into that at a later date, but the cases and connections I want to focus on most are other rings of pedophiles operating with the same MO and sharing the same pamphlets, magazines, and even copying and or cooperating with each other using the same filing systems. White index cards, where on several different police raids of these ringleaders' homes in different states across the country, they found they used the same system. These index cards, they had children's names on them. Stats like height, hair color, and in some cases even drugs they would be willing to take. But let's just call it originally forced upon them. Okay, I don't think an 8-year-old knows how to talk to a dealer to ask for some cocaine on the street. Hell, I'm in my 30s, and I would have no way of, and nor would I want to, ask for a street drug. But luckily, these pedophiles had stashes. Anything the kids wanted. So gross. And they got them addicted to a lot of times. But along with the thousands upon thousands of children's names on index cards that were confiscated, there were also index cards with a ton of client names. Again, in different busts, in different states across the country. Yet when investigators and journalists tried to file a public information request to view the clients and victims on these cards, in all of these cases, they somehow vanished or, and this is where good old Washington, D.C. comes in again, were sent to our nation's capital for investigation by the highest levels of authority. But then again, oopsie daisy, they don't exist anymore. And you know what? They weren't that interesting anyways, is probably what they were trying to tell people. Yet detectives who busted these rings can tell you the names of very interesting high-level people on those cards. They read them, but they were forced to turn them over. And like with Franklin, many of the high-level men on those cards were later arrested for child sexual abuse and, of course, with money and power, never served a day in jail. It's almost like they give the public just enough to feel like, okay, we caught a bad guy, it's all handled now. Like, they will either pick and choose maybe one prominent person, such as recently Jeffrey Epstein, to take the fall, and he completely deserves it, he was a freaking scumbag. But there's rarely a prominent guy that takes the fall. But they must have known that they had to kind of do this in Epstein's case because, you know, it was 2019 and they had to protect even higher level people. But most of the time, and especially in the 70s and 80s, it was the gym teacher involved who goes to prison. And the high level people rumored to be involved, well, as we'll see in the Boys for Sale documentary, and basically any Catholic church priest case, they explain it away as something else. They only act out when they're drunk. They have a drinking problem, a little rehab or alcohol counseling, and a quick shuffle around to another parish or some time off from their public job, and they are suddenly cured of their sexual abuse of children.
Weren't there a couple actually right-wing, new right representatives, congressmen in Washington,
Bauman,
who were actually found guilty of molesting?
Doug, I wish you were right. Mm-hmm. Congressman Robert Bauman was apprehended in February of 1980, having sex with a 16-year-old boy. For some reason, no charges were brought until September 1980. At that point, the FBI and the U.S. attorney made an agreement to keep all details of the account out of public records. The charges were dropped on Bauman's promise that he would take a drug or an alcoholic abuse treatment program. He continued in office and he ran for re-election.
Or even it never happened anyway. They're like, look away, sweep it under the rug, sweep it under the rug. Now, besides that, and perhaps the most significant of which I'll be covering over these final episodes in the Franklin scandal and pedophile rings connected, are the kidnapping of Johnny Gosch. And I shouldn't say it's the most significant because these are all, I mean, the Oakland County child killings, a huge unsolved case, all of the victims of all of this, but I guess the most significant and the ones that I think I can bring the most to the table on are the pedophile rings connected to the Franklin scandal, the rings connected to the kidnapping of Johnny Gosch, Johnny Gosch's connection to Paul Benassi, and a very creepy figure named John David Norman we will hear about later, and the connection to a place not far from Greg's ranch, right in Colorado. I chose this area to focus on because A, it's all too clearly connected in my mind, and in terms of the other ones, major podcasts like Crime Junkie covered North Fox Island, that's Francis Sheldon's pedophile island, and the possible Oakland County child killings connection. And Ashley Flowers did a great job. Amazing. So, I mean, you could just go to listen to her podcast and you'll kind of get that connection. And then I read the full Children of the Snow or Snow Killings. It's about the Oakland County child killer book. Huge information there. I mean, it's a whole deal. And then The Clown and the Candyman also spoke about that. And this is no shade to Ashley because she's amazing. And the Crime Junkie episode was great. But The Clown and the Candyman did a full series, and they did a brilliant job of compiling interviews with investigators, journalists, on the ground floor of these connections. And Jacqueline Bynum, the host and writer, also makes a strong case for the connections between all of these and serial killers Dean Corll and John Wayne Gacy. Both Jacqueline Bynum and Ashley Flowers do such a great job that you should just go listen to theirs about those specific connections. And additionally, like I said, the Oakland County child killer book, Snow Killings, Children of the Snow. I can't quite remember what it's called. I read the whole thing and there's so much information in there. But when no one has done yet, at least in the podcasting world, and maybe anywhere publicly besides some really genius Reddit threads and well-researched web sleuth, is go in-depth on the Johnny Gosch Colorado connection, where super predators like John David Norman, Larry King, and others who did some terrible shit in the state of Colorado. I've got names, I've got addresses, I've got places I'm going, court documents, FBI documents. But then I also have some very, very strange leads that, man, if they're true, all bets are off. Or I'm just crazy for looking into them. But it's worth trying for. I'm so sorry to end this podcast like slightly abruptly, but this was as far as I got in recording before I was told some pretty unimaginable news. The comedy community and family I spent over a decade with experienced a tragic, huge loss yesterday, and I just couldn't keep my head up to record the rest. You can feel free to Google the incident. The details are still fairly unclear, but good people died, and I guess one thing I want to say, love all of them. And I understand that drugs are drugs, addiction's addiction, but there are ways to avoid having tainted drugs in your system. So my good friend Sam Grody posted on Instagram after the incident happened that you can get testing strips that test for fentanyl and contamination and whatever drug you're trying to do. And I just hope if anyone's struggling, at least start with that resource and know that people love you, and harm reduction is the best thing we can do. And yeah, love you all. Sorry to be depressing.